Good evening, everybody. Evening. My name is Wes. It says in the program, Wes H. That H stands for Hamil. That's spelled H-A-M-I-L. Now, we just heard a little talk about anonymity. By the way, I am an addict. I'm also an alcoholic. Hi, thanks. You know, actually, I was thinking about it. You know how really accomplished people in life have their business cards and it says, you know, Mr. or Ms. blah, 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 comma, or period, PhD. They have all the initials after their name. And I was thinking about all the programs I qualify for. It could say Wes Hamil dot C-A, M-A, A-A, D-A, A-C-A, you know. And I'm thinking if somebody didn't know about us, and they looked at that business card, they'd think, wow, this guy's been busy, you know? To which the only appropriate answer would be, yes, I have been. I'm going to tell you how busy I was. The reason I tell you my last name, Hamil, H-A-M-I-L, is because I'm listed in the telephone directory today. Okay? There was a time that wasn't true. I'm listed in the telephone directory, so if it's midnight, if it's 1 in the morning, if it's 3 in the morning, if it's 5 in the afternoon, if your head attacks you, like my head sometimes attacks me, and you need to find somebody to talk to, you can call information, and you can say, I'd like a listing for Wes Hamil, H-A-M-I-L. He lives down in Littleton. Can I have his phone number, please? And they'll give it to you, and then you can call me. Because I believe anonymity is vital. It's very important. It preserves the sanctity of our fellowships, and it makes it safe for us to get sober. But I can become so anonymous that you don't know who I am. And I do not want to be anonymous within the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. I want you to know that my name is Wes Hamil, H-A-M-I-L, and you can call me. Okay? You know, it's a crazy world right now, and today's September 9th, 2006, and welcome to the Daily Reprieve. The most important thing that I can have right now is the safety of this room. This is the safest room in the world for somebody like me right now tonight. And if you think a minute about that statement, look around the room. There's a bunch of dope fiends, alcoholics, you know, crazy people, and yet there's a tremendous spirit of safety right here in the room, you know? My life depends on that safety. And so one of the things I got to do to keep this room safe is be a real person with you and not be somebody up here giving a talk, you know? Because me giving a talk doesn't do my recovery any good and it doesn't do you any good. I got to bring who I am, warts and all. And so what I got to tell you about right now is my twisted ego. Here's how twisted my ego is. As regards to this very night. A few months ago, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, Bill, I have the privilege of meeting with Bill every Tuesday. He's talking to me about the convention, and I want to thank the convention committee for the honor of being able to be here and speak tonight, and also just thank them for all this hard work that they have done to make this thing happen. This is a lot of work. You know, the convention fairy just doesn't show up and make these things go. Although magic dust has been known to float around some of us from time to time. Anyway, so what happens? He asks me, he says, hey, we're looking for an L.A. speaker. I'm like, cool, I'm from L.A., that's where I got sober. I'm not from L.A., but that's where I got sober. Kind of where my life started over. And by the way, I wore a black shirt tonight, so I would be all in black. So I would give the proper L.A. effect, you know. The hair combed back, the black, everything. But I had to get my Keep On Trudging shirt. I figured it was only right to have the you know, the official T-shirt of the thing going, so this is just, sorry I blew the whole black thing, you know. Denver's rubbed off on me, what can I tell you? Anyway, he said, You know, I tried to line up some L.A. speakers, and most of the guys I knew were traveling or working right now. And I know a lot of people in the entertainment business. It's part of my story. That's an addiction unto itself, which damn near killed me. But here's what happened to me, you know. He says, yeah, well, how about you? Why don't you speak at the state CA convention? And I am a cocaine addict. And I am, in fact, I'm an everything addict. Okay, put a Krispy Kreme in front of me, and we got trouble, okay? And my brain said, well, I've heard a lot of these guys' stories. What if I'm not a big enough addict to speak at the state CA convention? Maybe, you know, because I've heard some of their stories, and I never ended up in a burned-out building on the east side of town with a crack pipe in my mouth, and I stopped myself and went, how twisted is my ego and my thinking that I have to worry about, am I sick enough to come talk to you? I mean, that's just warped. Am I sick enough to talk to a bunch of cocaine addicts and alcoholics and God knows what else? Yes. I love the spirit of CA. I love the fire. I mean, Bill recently introduced us to the Nirvana meeting where we've been going. And I mean, I just love the fire in the belly here for CA. There's a big spirit here in the community. And I really like that, you know. I'm a real passionate person. I get fired up about stuff, you know, especially recovery. And so anyway, I'm thinking about this whole, was I sick enough? And I started thinking about, you know, the first time I ever put anything up my nose, it was actually not cocaine. It was that real chunky, god-awful yellow crystal methamphetamine.
Yeah.
It actually starts your sinus cavities burning about 4 inches away from your nose. And then by the time it hits your nose, of course, your head starts to explode and then it burns all the way down. And we were at this club in San Antonio, and this guy comes up and he says, hey, man, you know, we were musicians, you know, and he's like, really enjoyed your show, and you want to hang out tonight? I gotta rewire the lighting in the club. It was a 25,000 square foot nightclub. He goes, I gotta rewire the lighting in the club, you know, all the lights and this kind of stuff. And he's like, I'm going, tonight? He's going, yeah, man. But he goes, I got this. And he goes, starts waving this bag of crystal meth. And we're like, what's that? And he goes, oh, this is good. And we just took his word for it, you know? And, you know, so start snorting up this crystal meth and, you know, kept snorting up the crystal meth. And it was the bar, man. Everybody was gone home. There was just, like, unlimited booze. And, you know, we kind of, I don't know, it was like 12 or 14 hours. We snorted crystal meth and we drank and got in the car to drive home. And I was driving home. I was with my wife, Victoria. And I go, God, what happened to our car? And she's like, what do you mean, what happened to our car? And I go, it smells like there's a dead animal in here, you know? And I drive along a little further, and then I kind of go, oh, my God, I'm the dead animal. And I overdosed. First time out of the shot, I just passed out. A couple of days later, come to, and I went, we got to go find that guy and do some more of that. So because I started out on that non-habit-forming crystal methamphetamine, it leads to harder stuff. You got to watch it. My first experience with cocaine was, I was working with this guy. He was from Colombia. He was a keyboard player. He played with us, and he's like, his name was Andreas. I have no idea where Andreas is, back in Colombia for all I know, or hopefully somewhere in a room like this, somewhere in America. And he goes, hey, give me $50, man. Now this is, I don't know, when this was like 1980 or something. He goes, give me $50, man. And I'm like, why? And he's like, I'm going home to my sister's wedding. And I go, and I'm supposed to give you $50 to go home to see your sister? He goes, no, man, just trust me. So for some reason, in my alcoholic addictive wisdom, I gave the guy $50. Which $50, man, that was like, that's big money, okay? I mean, starving to death. I'm like 19 years old. I'm scraping to get, but I fork out my $50. About 2 weeks later, I get a Christmas card. It's July. I get a Christmas card. Noel, You know? I open it up. There's a bindle of cocaine in it. I'm like, what's this? It's like real white. It's not chunky yellow like I'm used to. It's real white, a little flat packet. And frankly, I was pretty disappointed. It didn't burn like the other. It wasn't cut with anything, man. This was like pure Colombian cocaine. It was sweet, okay? So I do this, and I get the numb, and I get the rush to the temples, and I'm like, oh, I like this too. This is good. This is not quite the same, you know, driving into a brick wall at 50 miles an hour that the yellow chunky stuff is, but it'll do. It's a sufficient substitute. So I do it, you know. We do it. Then we get the bright idea that the problem with our life, this is 1980. Figured out the problem with my life in 1980. San Antonio, Texas. That was the problem with my life. Okay? Anybody here been to San Antonio, Texas? I'm hearing any argument from anybody? I actually like San Antonio, but anyway, that was the problem with my life. So I decide I'm going to head for Denver, Colorado. All right? Now, this is how quick on the draw I am. We pack everything we own into a 1969 Chevy van, one of those panel vans with no windows. Privacy is very important. And we drive to Denver, Colorado, where I promptly hook up with this guy through a person I know from bars and doing drugs and alcohol with in San Antonio. Look up my ex-husband. That should have been a clue right there. You know, we start with ex-husband. It's probably not the best way to go. Hey, your ex-wife sent me to find you. He's like, why? You know, anyway, so he, do I need to be talking to you? I don't know. And so the short version of the story is I end up meeting this guy. He gives me in Victoria a place to stay up in Evergreen in this house he's building if I'll help work on the house. His handyman, an Englishman named Colin, says, hey, man, I know all the great places to drink in Evergreen, and I just happen to have plenty of cocaine. I had completely forgotten about the fact this guy carried around cocaine constantly until I started thinking about coming to speak at this meeting. I completely blanked it out. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. So what happens is, we do cocaine. I end up homeless in Denver, Colorado. I'm sleeping in the van. Victoria and I sleep in the van. We're relying on the graces of strangers, sleeping in people's living room floors. I'm homeless. You know, I didn't figure out until I was 5 years sober that I had ever been homeless. I didn't figure out that if you're in a town, you got no place to live, you're homeless. Kind of makes sense. I never put that together. It was just another little part of the journey, you know? Well, I went there, I just slept on these people's floor, I slept in the truck, it was cold, you know? I had this van wouldn't start unless you had it plugged into a block heater, you know, wall, outlet in the wall. Try being homeless and going around and finding an electric plug somewhere, you know? Hi, I'm a homeless guy. Can I plug my van into your house, you know? Crazy. So Denver didn't work out. Denver was the problem then. So I moved to Austin, Texas, where they would obviously appreciate the depth of who I was as a human being. And I got into the music business, and I ran a recording studio, and I met a guy real briefly that was going to be important in my sobriety later on, but he was going to be important as a ghost. We used to live down the street from a Texas guitar player named Jimmy Vaughn. And I'd run into his brother from time to time. And because we were all playing the same clubs. We were all doing the same circuit. And I met him a few times. And then right before I moved away from Austin, this guy got sober. And then the week before I moved away from Austin, having by that time figured out Austin was my problem, and that Los Angeles would surely be better. Gotta love the reasoning behind that. He got killed in a helicopter crash. So I moved to Los Angeles. And I'm in Los Angeles about 60 days, and I'm working on being a man about town. And we go to this art gallery opening, And we meet this photographer. We start talking to this photographer. The guy's named Robert Knight. He's a great photographer. Took the last photo of Jimi Hendrix taken before Jimi Hendrix died. He took the last photo of Stevie Ray Vaughan taken before Stevie Ray died. Bad luck for guitar players, this guy. But anyway. I like, don't ever take my picture, man. So anyway, he gives us this photo. It's a photo of the two brothers, the two Vaughn brothers. They're standing there. I have this photo hanging on the wall of my office. The people who've been in my office have seen it. This photo is standing there, and this guy, Stevie Ray Vaughan, as he's staring out at the picture, and hanging from his ear is a circle and triangle earring. Now, I knew what that symbol was. Okay? I knew it had something to do with sobriety. I didn't know anything about the fellowship. I didn't know anything about AA or CA or NEA, you know. FNA, maybe. But, so, I have this photo, and this guy gives it to us because we bond. We make this spiritual bond. We're talking about spirituality. And see, here's the thing for me. I have always, always, always been searching for a higher power. Always. Okay? When I was 16 years old, I had this amazing experience. I was driving home from this really disappointing day, you know, which I was 16. What else could it have been, you know? So anyway, I'm driving home. And I've got this little car, this little beat-up old convertible, and I drop the top on the car, and I'm going along, and I'm bitching and moaning, man. God, whine. And I'm whining to God, and I'm driving out this Texas Hill Country Road outside San Antonio, and this thought comes into my brain. This thought comes into my brain, and this thought is, I wonder if anybody ever asks God how God's. So I pull over to the side of the road. If you've ever been to Texas, especially at night, the sky is huge. It's just like huge. When you're outside of towns, the stars are like right, you could reach above your windshield and grab one. You know? Everything is this close, which is kind of like how it is when God's around, you know? Everything is this close. You can touch it. It's right here. Okay? So I have this thought, and I pull over, and I stop, and I lean my seat back, and I look up at those stars, and I go, okay, God, how you doing? And this amazing sense of peace and calm, like I had never felt, came over me. And man, I went, this is good. Okay? And then later on, when I took a big hit of whiskey, or when I took some cocaine, a sense of peace and calm came over me then, and I got confused. You know, I confused stepping outside of the self-obsession of the voices in my head. I confused spirit, whether in powder or alcohol form. I confused that spirit with spirituality, and it damn near killed me. And what happened was, we've been talking to this photographer. We've been talking about spirituality. He was talking program, and we were connecting. We didn't even know what he was talking about. He gave us this photo, and I put that photo up in my little one-bedroom apartment in Midtown Los Angeles, just about four blocks where about, 8 months later, every building was going to be on fire because of that little, you know, why can't we all just get along Rodney King thing to happen? Because I was living at ground zero when all that went off. And I couldn't, that photo, man, it was after me. It's like everywhere I went in the room, the eyes of that guy were like, you know, it's like one of those creepy mystery movies, you know, where the eyes move around in the painting, right? And so, Stevie Ray's eyes, man, they were on me because it was that damn earring, and I knew it had to do with being sober, and I knew I needed something different, and I didn't know what it was, and I put the photo in a box, and I stuck it in the top of my closet, and I go, I don't even want to look at that damn thing. And it stayed there for about 6 years into my sobriety. So how did I get sober? Well, you know, God works in his usual sense of humor way. I'd done this recording session in San Marcos, Texas, and one of the guitar players is a guy who played for Bonnie Raitt. And he was sober, but I didn't know that. And he was down, and I kept trying to get him high during the sessions. And this guy was a great guitar player. Man, he was really good. And he played with Dylan and Bonnie Raitt. Here he was playing on my record, and I'm like, rocking, man, like, dog. You know, although I didn't do that back then, but, you know. And so anyway, he's playing. I keep trying to get him to join the party, and he just like, no, man, no thanks. Had enough, blah, blah, the whole deal, all the little one-off lines. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And then when I walked out of the studio that night, my brain said, this guy's sober. Now, I've got this voice in my head saying the word sober, and I have no clue what sober means. It's just a word in my head, sober. Okay? So this is Austin. I moved to L.A. Now, this guy gets important later on. So my wife is working at a... And by the way, this is a pretty special weekend. This weekend is the 29th anniversary of our first date, my wife and I. You know what you're applauding for right there? You are applauding for the 12 traditions. Because we got married in 1980, and I got sober in 1991. And we've been married longer. And we've been sober married longer than we were loaded. And a lot of relationships don't last in sobriety. And sometimes that's a good thing. But I want you to know that if you're in this room and you're newly sober, or you're in a sober relationship and that's all new in sobriety, that the 12 traditions of our fellowships can absolutely guide you to a healthy and happy and balanced relationship with another human being. In fact, more than one. You know? But to get back to getting sober. She's working at this dental office. Because at this time, now my career path had been something like vice president of a $14 million $14 million company at the age of 25. At the age of 29, I'm mowing lawns for a living. Age of 30, I'm working in a pizza kitchen. By the time I'm 32, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles, writing song after song, nobody hears, and I'm afraid to go outside. So, and that's just how it looked on the outside. It was worse on the inside. As they say, you know, I was trying to be John Wayne on the outside while I was Shirley Temple on the inside. But you know, what happened is she was working, this guy comes in. He's got another circle and triangle earring. I should buy like 50 of these things and just hand them out. So anyway, he's got the circle and triangle earring on. And it's a guy, and I'm going to use his full name because like me, he has no anonymity inside the rooms, and that's how he trained me. His name's Paul Williams. Certain generation out here will have no clue who he is. Some of you will know him as the artiste who acted in the Smokey and the Bandit movies. He called him his art film trilogy. He's the little short guy. He's an Academy Award winning songwriter. I grew up watching this guy on TV. He was like one of my songwriting heroes. And he comes in and he's a patient of my wife's. And she's working on him. She goes, well, I know what that circle and triangle earring is. I know what that is. He, thinking a fellow member of our fellowships is like speaking up, goes, oh, really? And then she pipes up, that's the sacred Tejas. It is, in fact, the sacred Tejas. That symbol's been around for like 2,500 years. The circle is unity with God. The triangle is man searching towards it. So like any really good organization, one thing you learn in the entertainment industry is you learn the old saying that amateurs borrow and professionals steal. So, you know, AA stole good. And CA and everything else, you know, everybody uses that. So she sees that and she says, I know what that is. And she lays the sacred Tejas thing on him and he just starts laughing. He goes, well, you know, it's a symbol of a fellowship that I belong to where we stay clean and sober one day at a time. He goes, you have a problem with your drinking? This is drinking at the time, you know. Paul's a dear, good, he's a good, honest coke fiend too, man. We share that. And he goes, she goes, oh, God bless her for this answer, too. She goes, no, but my husband does. Now, she wasn't lying about her husband dying. She left out the part, and I won't tell her story, but let's just say that the scene in Indiana Jones where Karen Allen drinks all the other guys under the table. So, anyway, he goes, really? I'd like to talk to your husband. So, the next time he comes in, Victoria takes a demo tape of a song I've read, and she plays it for this guy. About 4 hours later, I get a phone call. I'm locked in my apartment. Where else am I going to be? I'm available for the phone. My day planner wasn't exactly jam full. So, voice comes over the phone, says, hi, this is Paul Williams. Now, I stifled the urge to say, right, I'm Johnny Carson. But I almost said it. Thank God there's a lot of stuff I've almost said. Anyway, he goes, and he starts singing me this song that I had written. And he says, your wife played that for me. Now, she had called me all excited, saying, hey, I got to play Paul this song. So I knew this had happened. That's how I knew it was really the guy who said who he said he was. And he said, I hear you're trying to stay sober. I go, well, yeah, what up, you know. And he goes, well, I'd like to meet you and talk to you about that. You going to meetings? I'm like, what meetings? What are you talking about? He goes, oh, we need to talk. I stayed sober 30 days, dry. By the way, I have this little thing I call so-dryety. Anybody here relate to so-dryety? I'm not drinking. I'm not using. I'm one miserable SOB. I have not found a sufficient substitute. And I had not. My wife came home, and she said something that changed my life. I'm not real proud of this, but I have to tell you the truth about it. She looked at me, and she said, you scare me. And that got my attention. You know, it's really hard to be an addict and an alcoholic and be the incredible kind of lonely that we can be. Man, we define lonely like nobody defines lonely. To lay in bed next to somebody that you know you love and you're still the loneliest person on the planet. To be in a group of people that you know care about you, and you are so frightened of letting them touch your heart that you're the loneliest person on the planet. That is me in my disease. And that is me in my disease whether I'm drinking and using or not. And that's real important to me. I don't want sobriety. I want sobriety. I want to be part of the tribe. So what happened is, I went the very next day to my first meeting. Now I got sober in AA. Shortly discovered CA after that. We had rockin' meetings. One of my best buddies in that fellowship out there is a guy named Bruce M., who wrote the part in the Who is an Addict about scraping the flakes out of, you know, brown bottles. I was like, this is cool. It's like meeting somebody who wrote the Declaration of Independence. Come up with that. Brilliant. He's like, well, it was about 3 a.m. We were out of pizza. We were working central office, waiting for the phone to ring. We were bored out of our minds, and we figured we got to write something for this fellowship. So that's how it happened. Just the ordinary way genius comes about, I guess. So I started on my journey in sobriety. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about that. I walked into a music store. Remember the guy I told you about earlier, the guitar player in the studio that was so good? I wanted to be just like. I'm in a little music store over in the west side of LA, and I'm talking to the owner, and we're talking about stuff, man. We're just talking about stuff. We're talking about stuff, and words like easy does it start slipping into the conversation, and words like, you know, surrender. There's a big one. And words like, you know, one day at a time. And so I go, "Are you sober, man?" And he goes, "I'm sober 27 years, the owner of this music store." And I go, "Wow." We immediately head for the back like corner of this place and just start having a meeting. Basically, we're just talking. And I get all fired up and I go, "Man, I worked with this guitar player in Texas and I know he was sober." And I told him his name and I said, "Blah, blah, blah. I'd love to meet him. He really inspired me. I wanted what he had." And the guy looks at me and he goes, "Well, I'm his sponsor." I go, "No kidding." He goes, "Yeah, man." And he goes, I go, "Look, I'm going to give you my phone number. If he's willing to call me, I just want to thank him." I turn to walk out the store. Who walks in the store? This guitar player. We almost like get stuck in the door together going like this. I go, and he's like looking at me like, "Who the hell's this guy?" And, you know, he doesn't remember me. I'm like one of 500 things he's played on in the last 3 years. And I tell him the story. I thank him. He gets really moved by this. He gives me his home phone number. 2 years later, when I go in to make the first record I'd made in years, the first record I was going to make sober, he came down and played on it for me. He did that for free. He did it just to be of love and service. That's what we do. You know, who knew? See, I don't have the big picture. I don't know how to connect the dots. I don't know how a scared kid in a recording studio in Austin, Texas, seeing some guitar player that has something he wants, I don't know how you get from there to 2 years sober in Los Angeles meeting a guy walking through the door of a music store. I don't know how that works. That's the mystery, man. And nothing's better than a good mystery. And that's sobriety, and that's life. It's a mystery. When I was about 14 months sober, everybody's talking about spirituality, 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 spirituality. God, 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 God. I'm like, "God damn it, enough." Enough with the God thing already. Two important things happened to me. I sat across from my sponsor. He starts talking about God, 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 God. I start explaining God back to my sponsor. Because I've read a book or two. I must know something. Boy, that's dangerous, huh? Little bit of information in the hands of an addict. Ooh. Scary. You know what I do with a little bit of information in the hands of an I do what this little thing is I call... I start making movies. I bet everybody here makes movies. Here's how a movie is. I get a little piece of information. My car isn't running right, says the mechanic. Piece of information. I start a movie. I'm in a great mood when I get this phone call, by the way. I am like rocking. I'm walking hand in hand with God. Phone rings. "Hey, your car, it's got a little bit of a miss. We need to look into it." Movie starts. "It's going to be $1,500. I know it. Probably totaled the damn car. I'll be homeless by the end of the week. Nobody's going to ever love me." Making movies, man. I start out Bambi. I turn into Stephen King. I make movies. Got to watch those movies. Not literally. You got to watch out for making them. Inventory, you know. Inventory says it's fact-finding, not feeling-finding. Save my butt. So I'm sitting across from my sponsor. I bet you thought I lost track of where I was, didn't you? Sitting across from my sponsor. ADD works for you sometimes. Sitting across from my sponsor, and I'm laying it out, man, God, and I, Tibetan Book of the Dead, and blah, 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 Yi Ching, and blah, blah, blah. And he stops, and he goes, "Man, I am hearing all this." And he starts thumping on his forehead. And he said, "And I am hearing none of this." He starts thumping on his heart. He shut me right up, because he couldn't have been more right. You know, I was going to think my way into this conscious contact. My higher power. So that really spun my wheels. I'm like, "I'm screwed now. You just took away my last line of defense, my intellectual posturing." I think if I can put together a sentence without too many "uhs" in it, you know, I'm going to get one past you. But but you guys are too clever. So he nailed me on that. And a few weeks later, I went to this spiritual experience. And I went with some fellow members, in the, you know, 12-step members. And when I'd been in Austin, Texas, I'd done this thing called a sweat lodge. It's a prayer ceremony. Some of you guys may know about what this is. It's Native American prayer ceremony. Hell, we're all Native Americans, most of us. I don't see too many immigrants fresh off the boat here. But it was an American Indian prayer ceremony. And I went to it, and the guy, I mean, it was a guy that worked for the post office. They ran this. And I sit in this thing, and it rocks my world because it makes me be completely present. Now, I don't wear a watch right now. It's been a few months because I started doing this. I'm surrounded by clocks all the time, clocks at work, clock on my computer. I'm looking at my wrist all the time. Every 7 minutes, I'm looking at this thing. What, I can't remember what time it was 7 minutes ago? I'm just, you know what? I'm trying to be someplace other than where I am. So I quit wearing a watch because the time I need to be aware of is right now. I had to borrow my wife's watch, so, you know, I don't want to go too long here and screw up anybody's evening. So I was in this ceremony, man, and these people were praying from their heart. And I was right here. And after that ceremony, this guy looked at me and he said, he's an Indian guy. They don't talk a lot. You know, that's Indian, feathers, not dots kind of Indians. And he goes, got to make the distinction. You know. And he says to me, you can come back. That's all he says to me. You can come back. I'm like, what does that mean? Somebody, I asked somebody, what does that mean? He says, well, it means you can come back. Always looking for that deeper hidden meaning. So anyway, I went back to this guy's house a couple of nights later. He took one look at me and he says, so, you know, you can come back tomorrow too. And what happened was an apprenticeship. And I spent the next 6.5 to 7 years of my life studying at that guy's knee. And I got to go places in the realm of the spirit that I never would have imagined. I'm going to tell you one story right now about something that happened to me, one of these ceremonies. It has everything to do with recovery. And that's the only reason why I'm telling a story. It's not an outside issue because, you know what? It's my life, and my life is not an outside issue to me. This is how I got here. So I started out down this journey. And he said, you're going to go do a vision quest. That's going to involve like going without food for a long time, by the way. And you're going to go face the four enemies of man. I'm like, the four? All four at once? And he's like, well, you're going to do them one at a time, but you're going to do them in this ceremony, the four enemies of man. I go, well, you want to tell me what they are? He goes, sure. We're going to start with fear. I'm like, okay, that makes sense. We want to go to enemy number two, clarity. I'm like, how's that? Because I've been like sitting in meetings and everybody's praying for clarity. I'm like, well, how's that the enemy? He goes, well, you know, you're going to let me know if you live through this. He did say, if I live through this, too. It's really unsettling. And then he said, power. There's your number three. And he said, number fourth enemy is going to be death. What you're going to do is you're going to go out in the desert. I chose the Joshua Tree Desert. I don't know if any of you guys know where Joshua Tree is. It's sort of like a little chunk of the moon that fell off and landed on Earth. And you're going to go out there, and you're going to be in prayer and meditation for 3 days and three nights. And you're going to ask every one of these enemies to appear to you in physical form. I'm like, okay. And I'm going, Joshua Tree, huh? And he goes, yeah, that or your living room. And I'm saying that because there's the reason why I'm saying that. So I go to Joshua Tree, scared to death. Drive out there at the middle. It's 2 in the morning. I drive out there. My God, it does look like the moon. I get all my stuff. I look, because I got my gear, man. Now, this is a real important part of the story. I got my stuff. Okay? I got my sacred feathers. my sacred rocks. I've got my sacred pipe. And I'm not mocking any of this stuff. I'm very serious. I have my sacred blanket, my sacred sunscreen. Maybe I'm mocking that one a little bit. I am a pretty pale-complected guy. And I go out in the middle of the desert and naturally just hiking a mile or so off the road is not good enough for my grandiose spiritual seeking. I hike like 4 miles into the open desert because it's got to be real. Got to be big. I'm an adrenaline junkie, you know. I'm addicted to the buzz. I still am. A little disappointed I didn't see adrenaline on the beverage menu tonight. So anyway, I hike all the way out there. I'm sitting there. I'm kind of like working with this fear thing. I won't go into all the details of how this stuff appeared to me in a physical form, but it did, and I'd be happy to talk to people, you know, afterwards about that. But what's important is I got through fear, and I got through clarity. I learned a really important thing about how clarity is my enemy, which I will share with you. Now, you may disagree with this, and that's cool, because the thing about ceremony, and by the way, sobriety is a ceremony, baby. Ceremony is presenting yourself to life completely. That's the definition of ceremony. Sobriety is ceremony. Everybody in this room knows what it's like to be on a vision quest. If you've done a fifth step, you've done a vision quest. You have shown up and brought the scariest parts of who you are to the light. That's a vision quest. So I'm out there in the middle of the desert. And this ceremony required me to wander around and do all this different, you know, we used to call it ooey owie ichi gowie stuff, you know. Because you got to laugh at it, otherwise you're just scared to death. It's about 3 in the morning. Clarity, what I learned. Clarity is my enemy when I get it and do nothing with it. Okay? I do a fifth step. I learn all about my character defects. I learn about these fears, these unreasonable demands. I learn about my brokenness. I learn about these things inside me that have driven me to run from life and use cocaine and alcohol and Haagen-Dazs and you name it. Okay? And armed with that information, I do nothing. I don't do the sixth step. I don't do the seventh step. I don't go out and make amends. Now I am trapped in everything I know that I am doing nothing about. And the only thing worse than being in abject misery and not knowing why is being in abject misery and knowing why and then doing nothing about it. Clarity as an enemy. So I got that one. Got that on that vision quest. Now it's power. 3 in the morning, I get up, I'm going to do my thing. The time, the spirits feel right. I take about 4 steps out into the Mojave Desert out there, and it's like 500 photographers took strobe pictures of me like a millisecond apart. It was like a ring of flashbulbs going off around me. This is 3 in the morning. It's pitch black. And I'm just like, oh my God. And I become completely disoriented. And in that moment, I have no idea what my name is. I don't know where I am. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm completely lost, lost in the dark in the middle of the desert. And I go, my God, I've got to find my way back to my little spot. I had my little sacred spot, you know. I had my hat. I had my sunscreen. I had my sacred rocks and feathers and all the stuff that was going to make me okay and keep me safe. I had my stuff. And I'm wandering out in the desert. The sun comes up. I'm still wandering. I'm completely lost. I figure out my name by around sunrise. But I don't know where I am. If you've ever been to Joshua Tree or even seen a picture, you get out there and you look and it's just a million Joshua trees. It all looks the same. So I'm trying to pick out, I can't find where I came from. And I start wandering. If I don't find my way back to that spot, I'm in trouble. Because that's where my safety, I can hide in the shade of my blanket, I can weather the 108 degree heat, I'll be okay. I keep looking for the spot, I can't find the spot, I can't find it, I keep looking, I'm not giving up. I am a little self-will run riot. I start getting cramps in my leg. Now, it's about 10 in the morning, I'm guessing. And I get to the point where I can't walk more than 3 steps without cramping up and falling over. So I cramp up and I fall over and I dig a little hole in the sand and stick my face in it, face down into the sand to hide from the sun. I can already feel my skin starting to turn red and blister from the sun. It's 10:30 in the morning. It's already 100 degrees. Why I went out there in June, who knows? It was bigger that way. I'd have the big experience. My ego demanded it. So I'm lying there face down, and this voice, really clear, calm, comes into my head, and it says, "This is about power." I'm like, I'm listening. He said, this voice said to me, "You've been wandering around for 6 hours trying to find all this stuff that you have given power to. Your sacred rocks, and your sacred feathers, and your sacred blanket. You have empowered them with such importance that they could kill you." Does that sound anything remotely familiar? Does that sound like cocaine to you? Sure does to me. Does it sound like alcohol to you? It sounds like alcohol to me. Does it sound like people, places, and things as a higher power to you? It sounds like that to me. And I'm lying there, and this voice said to me, "You have a choice." Now, a lot of people I really loved had given me those things, which made it even worse, because I had invested my sense of my relationship with those people into those objects. I confused what they gave me with the love they had for me. And so what I did is listen to that voice, and that voice said, "You can get up now, and I will give you the strength to walk out of this desert. Or you can keep looking for that stuff, and you're on your own." And like a good addict, it took me a while to make up my mind. I don't know. Maybe die? Make it. Die? Make it. Tough one. I really like that rock. I'm a silly man. So what I did is I chose to leave the stuff in the desert. And I swear, God is my witness, standing before you tonight, that where I could not take 3 steps without falling down, I stood up, and not only did I walk 4 miles back to where I parked my car, but I walked straight back to where I parked my car like somebody had drawn a dotted line in the desert back to it. And I had this horrible sense of loss, just like I did when I got sober. Because God, how am I going to live without what I need to make me okay? See, isn't that the tragedy of me and my disease? I've got to have cocaine to make me okay. I've got to have alcohol to make me okay. I've got to have a sacred rock to make me okay. And I left it in the desert. So I get back, and my teacher, the guy from the post office, shows up. He goes, "What happened to you, man? You look bad." And I was like, Power got me, man. He goes, "Yeah, no kidding." He said, So that stuff you left up there, do you think it, now this is interesting the way he put it, do you think it's willing to be found? I went, "Well." So it's like about it, like the spirit of that stuff, not about me. He asked me if I was willing to go find it. He asked me if it was willing to be found. I said, "Yes." So then he asked me to do something I thought was just completely stupid. But hey, you know, I was in a good bargaining position at this point. Damn near dead. He said, "We're going to go up and we're going to stand on this tallest rock over here, out in Joshua Tree. And you're going to close your eyes, and when you feel like you know where that stuff is, I want you to start walking towards it and never second guess yourself." So I was like, this is pretty dumb. but I'm going to give it a shot. Why? Because you guys taught me that the barrier to my spiritual growth is contempt prior to investigation. And I had not investigated this yet. So I went and did what he said. I started walking. I walked straight to it. 4 miles out into the open desert, I walked straight to that stuff. And you know what? Here's the scary part of it all. Around all this stuff, I saw my boot prints. Hundreds of my boot prints. I had circled that stuff and never seen it. It's just like, that. If that's not God talking to me about how my sobriety works, you know? You guys are right in front of me and I don't see you sometimes. Recovery in the 12 steps is right there and I don't see it. Then I'm in sobriety, which sucks. So, that was a lesson in surrender. It was a lesson in what I give power to. And I'm real grateful for that. And it served as a metaphor for my journey. I think I'm getting close to end of time. I want to tell two quick stories. I was sober about 5 years. I went to a meeting. And this guy is sitting there and he's saying, my name's Bob. I'm grateful to be sober today. I need to share about my sponsor. My sponsor's named Frank. Or he was named Frank. I'm like, uh-oh, this doesn't sound good. He goes, Frank was 45 years sober. And he died last month. And I just went to his funeral. He died drunk. See, because what happened to Frank was, Frank had helped, he'd been sober in Chicago, and he helped all these people. And one night, his wife, who was also sober, kind of got on his case about something. He just took great offense at this. He worked up an instant resentment over it. And with 45 years of sobriety, he went out and bought a six-pack of beer, and no one saw Frank again. Because they found him about 5 days later dead under an overpass. Because he bought more after that. And he bought some whiskey. I don't know if he used drugs or not, but it was too much for his system, and he died. And his wife eulogized him. She said, I love Frank, and he helped a lot of people, and I'm going to miss him. But you know, there was one problem Frank had. In the end, he ended up with too many years and not enough days. And I want to give that one to you guys. It's a daily reprieve. Last thing I want to share is this. My problem with living is what I think about my life. It's how I think. And I'm an addict, which means when I want things to change, I want them to change now. And this is what sobriety's taught me. Because I don't believe it has to be slow sobriety. It's not my experience. Okay? I believe that at any moment, I am one thought away from my higher power. If I'm disconnected, I only have to find one thought and change it. Where am I separating myself from you and from my higher power? One thought. Nothing changes faster than a thought. You want to change the way you feel, take an action that changes a thought. For me, it's helping somebody else. That changes my thoughts in a hurry. I'm not focused on me. I'm not making movies. Last thing I want to do is I want to close with a prayer. It's a blessing, actually. My teachers on that road of all the sweat lodges and vision quests and all that, they taught me this great prayer. I collect prayers now like I used to collect barroom toasts. And this is my best one. I'm going to lay my very best one. I'm not giving you, you know, B-level stuff here. This is my best prayer. It goes like this. It talks about walking in beauty. Okay? When you are walking in beauty, I've got to tell you what that means so you understand the prayer. It means that your intellect, your thoughts, your mind is balanced with your emotions. Okay? And it means your spirit is balanced with your physical health. And if those four things are like four directions on the compass, you're right in the middle, perfectly balanced. You are walking in beauty. So what I would like to close with is the following prayer from me, and it is my wish for you. As we leave this sacred and holy place, may beauty walk before you. May beauty walk beside you. May beauty walk above you, and may beauty walk below you. When you touch, may you touch with beauty, and may you always leave beauty in your trail. Thank you very much for letting me share.